The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Larkin, Judge Ross, Judge Bjorkman, the Honorable Michelle A. Larkin presiding.
Good morning and welcome to this Zoom session of the Minnesota Court of Appeals on February 13th, 2024. We have four cases on our calendar this morning. The first is A23-1744 in the matter of the civil commitment of Roderick Dean Pouncey Jr. Is each of the attorneys familiar with our Zoom protocols? Have you appeared on Zoom before? Yes. All right, then. We will hear first from Appellant's counsel. Please state your name, each of you, before each leg of the argument, so we have you identified for the audio recording that is made available to the public. Okay, Appellant's counsel may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Jennifer Tone. I am the attorney for the appellant in this case, Roderick Pouncey Jr. This appeal follows the trial court's order committing Mr. Pouncey as a sexually dangerous person and sexual psychopathic personality. One of the arguments that we've raised on appeal is whether or not Mr. Pouncey is highly likely to reoffend and or dangerous to others as required by the statute for civil commitment. The first point that I want to address at argument today is factor repetition by the district court. The prediction of risk includes consideration of the risk assessment tools and the Linehan factors. The trial court must determine what evidence is relevant to that highly likely determination. In so doing, the trial court must explain what evidence it found most or least persuasive, what facts it found to be most or least important, and which Linehan factors were significant in the ultimate resolution of the case. Here, the trial court acknowledged the potential for factor repetition, but did not avoid it. In this case, the doctors used three risk assessment tools.
How do we know from the district court's, I think, very thorough findings and express statement that I know I cannot double count, if you will, that in fact that's what the district court did? Why should we conclude that?
I think because when you look at the findings, there's a specific finding that says the three risk assessment tools the trial court found to be relevant and persuasive. And in a separate finding, the court found that the Linehan factors were both useful and helpful. And then in yet another finding, the trial court says, I am giving particular weight to these four Linehan factors. And when you look at the things that are incorporated within those Linehan factors, they're the same as or similar to the same things that are considered by the risk assessment tools that the trial court also gave weight to. And I think relying on both those tools and the Linehan factors is double counting. If you don't show your work, you can't just proclaim that you're not doing something without showing your work. And as I illustrated in the brief, when you look at the particular Linehan factors that the court gave particular weight to, demographic characteristics, history of violence, similarity of context, and sex offender treatment record, those things are all directly accounted for within the tools that the court gave weight to. And I think that's a clear example of double counting. You also, I think, have this finding, a conclusion from the trial court. So you've got your very specific trial court findings about the weight it's giving the tools, the Linehan factors, those four Linehan factors in particular. And that's not meaningfully tied to the conclusion of law number 9, where it's this kind of global conclusion that says the trial court is crediting everything, all of the risk assessment tools, all of the Linehan factors, all of the clinical opinions, everything. And so again, I go back to that. The trial court must, with particularity, explain what evidence it found most or least persuasive and most or least important, and show its work, if you will, when you're making that determination in order to specifically avoid that double counting in this case.
But let's assume for the sake of argument that let's just take out of the record all of the risk assessment tools. Why wouldn't the rest of the evidence submitted be sufficient to support the district court's determinations?
So if you took out the tools, I think, first of all, the opinion is based on, you know, the recommend or the opinions of Dr. Thompson and Dr. Doherty. Dr. Thompson in particular specifically testified that he doesn't find the Linehan factors to be current, up to date. He finds the law to be behind the science. And so he testified that his opinion isn't based on the Linehan factors. It's primarily just based on that static 99R risk assessment tool. So if you take out the tools, his opinion, there isn't much left because he's not relying on the Linehan factors and giving that opinion. And then I think you also go to the fact that kind of the second point is you have the trial court making a specific finding that the opinions of both doctors are credible, persuasive, and supported by the record. But when you actually look at the record and the findings, you're going to see numerous examples of where the doctors were internally inconsistent in their opinions. At times, their opinions were unsupported by the record. At times, they contradicted each other's opinions.
And they acknowledged, I think, both of them in cross-examination, that they may have scored the static 99 incorrect because they assumed that your client had been convicted of some of at least one or two of these numerous offenses, but we know he was not because of incapacity. And the two doc I mean, the two doctors overall, even when faced with inconsistencies in their testimony, in even faced with the scoring errors, didn't they both testify that their opinions did not change and that your client meets the criteria for both commitment under both STP and SPP?
They did, but I think that's the problem. Again, you can't just summarily opine something without explaining how you get there so that the court understands what that opinion is comprised of. You know, if an opinion is flawed, whether it's due to not understanding the record correctly or not using tools correctly or misunderstanding the case law, as Dr. Doherty did, you know, I think overall, when the trial court is making its determination about commitment, these things matter. And you can't just say, I think this guy meets the record, right? Or meets the criteria. We talked about this. That's clinical judgment. That's using your gut. That's a less than a coin flip shot of reliability. And when you're talking about indefinite civil commitment, due process requires way more than that. You can't just say, I have a feeling, I'm a doctor, I think the guy meets commitment, even though, and dear court, please ignore all of the flaws and mistakes that I've made, and still have that be found credible and persuasive and supported by the record. You know, I think that trial court finding, by taking that one step further and saying these opinions are supported by the record, that is very clearly erroneous in this case. And there are numerous examples of that throughout the record.
Well, if we agreed with you on this point and but only this point, wouldn't the remedy be to remand for additional findings rather than an outright reversal at the end of the proceedings?
I don't think so, because when you look at the record as a whole, does it reasonably tend to support the trial court's findings? I think the answer is no. And I don't think you just keep getting multiple bites at the apple in terms of beef up your order until you can get the result that you want that's going to
Well,
pass
I'm
appellate.
suggesting if we agreed with you on this point about the district court's analysis, the written findings, not any other of your points, would you agree that at most, if this is the only argument that prevailed, there would be a reverse and a remand for findings, not an outright reversal and an end to the proceedings?
I certainly can understand that question, and I certainly can't say that you're absolutely wrong or anything like that. I certainly would understand that result. I guess I would urge the court, though, when you're looking at the record and whether or not the findings actually made, because there are a number of very particular findings from the trial court, and those as a whole do not rise to clear and convincing evidence. And so I think, on the other hand, I guess my response to you would be the record as a whole does not support that clear and convincing burden that the county have. And I think under the clearly erroneous review that the court can reverse the order.
What's missing in the record? I mean,
What's missing?
what evidence is lacking that supports your contention that it's the evidence is not clear and convincing?
The incompetent examiner opinions. Again, I mean, the fact that Dr. Thompson only used one particular risk assessment tool, repeatedly acknowledged that he scored it wrong, needs to go back and review it. And that's all his opinion is based on, is
Well,
that one particular
he's the
tool.
pre-petition screener. He's not holding himself out as the one who has met with your client and done the
Right.
full blown. I mean, so, and when you talk about misscoring, and again, then we get back to the question of he wasn't actually convicted. He was only, charged with these crimes and because of his incompetency, couldn't. I mean, is that really enough to say the evidence isn't sufficient or isn't clear and convincing?
So I think you have to go a little bit deeper than that. So when you look at the static 99R, there's a difference in scores from anywhere from 4 to 7, which is a statistically significant difference, I would argue. right? So you're looking at, on those 5-year risk estimates, almost a doubling of the percentage to reoffend. But again, even looking at like Dr. Doherty's use in an analysis on the static 99R, you know, he also made a number of mistakes in scoring that particular tool, acknowledged and conceded that he needed to go back and rescore, that he was wrong on a number of points. You know, he used the VRSSO. And when he was talking about the significance of the results for that tool, he repeatedly made comments such as, the scores don't mean much. When you
Well,
combine
the number in and of itself doesn't mean much, but where that number puts you in the range, right? And I understood from the record that both doctors saying, yeah, let's adjust these scores, that your client is still in the above average risk category, even rescoring them. Isn't that
Sure.
accurate?
You're correct, but there's two things to look at that. So there's those nominal risk categories, well above average, average, et cetera. Dr. Thompson specifically testified that he doesn't like to use those categories because that is not a fair or clear way to understand risk. Again, the trial court credited that finding, yet the trial court made findings using the language that you just stated. So that's one aspect of it. But the other part, that's not the only information we get from the static 99R. We also get those 5-year, 10-year, and 20-year, which is considered lifetime risk estimates. And I submit that that's the really the most critical piece of information from that risk assessment tool. We are looking at whether or not Mr. Pouncey is highly likely to reoffend, and we're looking at his lifetime. And when you look at those numbers and you put that into context, you know, the percentages are significantly greater odds that he is not going to commit a new offense in his lifetime. And I think that's the important data. You know, and kind of going back
On
to
the
that.
other hand, you have his history of offense, right? From 2014 all the way until his arrest in 2022. I mean, obviously, the number of charges, the number of victims, the number of domestic incidents, I mean, that's all part of the evidence that the district court was required to consider in determining the risk of future dangerousness, future
Certainly.
sexual offense, correct? It's not just the actuarial tools.
Certainly, but all of those things you just mentioned are accounted for within the actuarial tools, which the trial court gave credit to, and the Linehan factors, which the trial court gave credit to. And you can't have it both ways. And so again, you know, risk assessment doesn't always make common sense. There are certain things that are nuanced. That's why we have experts to score these tools, to explain this stuff to the trial court, to help put it into context. And in this particular case, when you have doctors that are not able to do that very clearly and are very inconsistent with themselves and each other, I don't think you can reasonably find that to be clear and convincing evidence. Yes, you have to consider all of those things, but again, then you also have to show your work as the trial court. These are tough decisions, but you're required to make, you know, those findings. What evidence specifically is most or least important? What evidence is most or least persuasive? You can't just say, I considered everything. Everything's kind of sort of important. And taking that together, I find that he meets the criteria for commitment. The other point I wanted to touch on too, and I just want to distinguish and make sure it's clear what our argument is on that finding that the trial court articulated, saying both doctors are credible, persuasive, and supportive. I certainly understand that the trial court has discretion. They're the finder of fact. They're there viewing all the witnesses. They're the ones in position to judge credibility. But again, I think it's critically important in this case that the trial court did not account for any of the inconsistent or varied opinions, either within internally for each doctor and as between the two of them. And again, you've got this finding saying that those opinions are supported by the record. They're credible, they're persuasive. And then the trial court made numerous other findings that directly contradicted those opinions of the doctors. And I think that is clear error, that is reversible, and does require this court to reverse the trial court's finding.
Just trying to imagine on a reversal and remand, the district court looking at these circumstances again. I'm just trying. I'm having a difficult time seeing the district court having difficulty reaching a determination of significant risk when you have an individual who has not all convictions, but you have on average two offenses a year. For 8 years, more than 8 years, significant offenses, sexual and domestic incidents. I know we're not the fact finder. I'm just trying to imagine this going back to the district court and having a different result if we focus on the particulars that you're asking us to focus on and reverse on those bases.
Sure. And part of the answer, I think, is that the tools used by the examiners account for those things, right? So the static 99R considers violent convictions, the domestics that you mentioned. It also specifically looks at sex offenses, obviously, and that's both charged and convictions. So that Mr. Pouncey does not have a sexual conviction, he can still be scored on the static 99R. That still accounts for those charges. You know, there's also an item that looks at number of sentencing dates and some other particular things. So when you look at those tools as a whole, the concern that you're raising, the tools account for those things to the extent they're actually relevant to risk and the determination by the district court. And with that, I see I'm out of time. Thank you.
You'll of course have 5 minutes on rebuttal if you choose to use it. Now we'll hear from counsel for respondent. Please identify yourself before you begin your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm Kelsey Kelly, and I represent Anoka County in this matter. Your Honors, the district court made extensive factual findings about the credibility of each witness and findings to support each and every statutory element of the SDP and SPP statutes. This case was not a close call based on the record before it. The district court had no reasonable alternative other than to commit Mr. Pouncey based on these two statutes to protect public safety. I first want to turn to appellant's argument about the factor repetition issue. The district court explicitly addressed this in paragraph 262 of its order, and it actually flat out says that it's trying to give the benefit of the doubt as to this issue to the appellant in this case. Factor repetition was not an issue in the district court's finding.
How do we know that? Your counsel for appellant urges us or tells us we need to be looking for an express finding by the district court as to what was the most persuasive and the least persuasive evidence to ensure that factor repetition, double counting did not occur. How do you respond to that argument?
Your Honor, I do think that you need to look at the record as a whole here. The fact that the appellant's behavior was escalating over time in terms of the violent nature of it and the escalation of the criminal offenses. He goes from fifth degree crimsex all the way up to first degree crimsex over time. As Judge Ross previously pointed out, he was committing approximately at least two offenses a year. And the district court pointed out in its order that many criminal offenses go unreported. And I think you also have to look to the fact that this Mr. Pouncey spent a lot of time in other settings to try to get treatment for this issue. He had multiple times where he received treatment and the treatment was not working. Also, there was a witness that explained that there was no community setting that would take him and that the only alternative was for him to go to custodial treatment where he is now. You have to look at all of those issues to see that the district court was not double counting. There was no alternative for Mr. Pouncey based on his behavior. He received all of the treatment that he could receive and he continued to escalate in the violence of his behavior.
So are you suggesting then that finding 262 that identifies factor repetition as something to be avoided, that in and of itself is sufficient showing of work by the district court for us to be convinced that double counting did not occur?
I don't think that paragraph 262 just by itself. I think that if you look at this over 50-page order, you can see that the district court extensively showed its work. You can see where the district court attempted to avoid factor repetition, and he made explicit credibility findings, and also he made findings about likelihood of potential harm in the future, and he really relied on the harm in the past. And I think he even said that his biggest concern was this person's past criminal history and his behavior. And that was the biggest indicator of future behavior. The district court made that finding in paragraph 263. So I don't think you would have to just rely on one paragraph for that. You can see that woven throughout the district court's order that he's intentionally trying to avoid the double factor counting. Next, I want to talk about the issues raised by appellant as to the alleged conflicting examiner opinions. And these examiners were examining Mr. Pouncey at different times in the proceedings, and they were basing it off of, the pre-petition part and then the part where I think Dr. Doherty actually met in person and had more information. And the district court did point out the discrepancies between the two doctors. The district court pointed out the fact that the doctors didn't get everything 100% right, especially with the fact that he wasn't actually convicted of any of these offenses because of his incompetence under Rule 2001. So I think that the district court, he's saying that these examiners, they are persuasive, but then the district court points out that the examiners do admit that they're not perfect. The thing is, they both conclude, even after incorporating the cross-examination questions and the fact that they made a few small errors, both examiners still found that the petitioner or the appellant met the SDP and SPP statutory elements. And that's what is important, that both of these examiners did acknowledge that they weren't perfect. They still recalibrated their opinion based on that and still both found that Mr. Pouncey met the statutory elements for commitment.
I think another argument we've heard from appellant is that Dr. Doherty, in particular, did not apply the Linehan factors. Is that a problem, or why wouldn't it be?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think that's an accurate way to interpret the record, but even if that were true in the record, it's not a problem because it's really ultimately the court's determination whether to commit this person and what weight to give those legal factors. And the court did its independent analysis based on numerous witnesses, numerous exhibits, and the court analyzed the Linehan factors. And I believe that is in paragraph 260. The district court showed his work. Over 50 pages of showing his work. So I don't think, even if the doctor did mess up, the district court did the work here, showed his work. If the court has no further questions of me, the county relies on its brief and the record. I ask the court to affirm. Thank you.
Are there any additional questions for counsel for respondent? Okay. Then we'll hear from appellant's counsel again. Please state your name for the record before beginning.
Jennifer Tone again, attorney for appellant Mr. Pouncey. I guess I just have a couple of points in rebuttal here. Right at the end, counsel made a couple comments about the volume or the length of the record. And we know from the Spicer case law that just because you have a voluminous order with lots of findings doesn't mean that it's sufficient. When Your Honor asked counsel about, how do we know that the court didn't double count? I didn't really hear a substantive answer. It was, well, it's a lengthy order, and we just know that because the court made all these different findings. Again, I go back to my point that the court did not show its work. It did not tell us what evidence was most or least persuasive. We have these general, broad findings that the doctor opinions are supported, credible, persuasive. And then you have all these other individual findings that directly undercut that finding. And to me, that is clear error, and it is reversible by this court. Other than that, I guess I don't have anything in rebuttal, but I'm happy to answer any more questions the court might have.
Are there any questions? Seeing none, the matter is submitted. Thank you both for your briefing and your arguments. You'll have our decision within 90 days. That concludes the hearing.
Thank you.